buts. Given my crappy day, none of this should be working on me, but it definitely is. It's his complete lack of self-consciousness. He doesn't care if he's making a fool of himself. His only goal is to make me laugh. It's a long song, and he's hot and sweaty by the end of it. After he's done, he watches the monitor until a candy pink cartoon microphone dances across the screen and holds up a sign, 99%. The screen fills with confetti. I groan. You didn't say there would be grades. He throws me a triumphant grin and collapses on the seat right next to me. Our forearms brush and separate and brush again. I feel ridiculous for noticing it, but I do notice it. He moves away to retrieve the microphone and hand it to me. Bring it, he says.
I wish I thought about doing Norebang earlier. Being alone with her in a dimly lit room is a little bit of heaven. Disco heaven. She's flipping through the songbook and making noises about being a terrible singer. I'm staring at her, getting my fix in, because she's too distracted to tell me to quit doing it. I can't decide what part of her face is my favorite. Right now, it might be her lips. She's holding the bottom one in her teeth in what I think is her "the agony of too many choices" face. Finally, she chooses. Instead of picking up the remote, she bends over the table to reach it and enter the code. Her dress pulls up a little, and I can see the back of her thighs. They have little crease marks from the couch. I want to wrap my hand around them and smooth the marks with my thumb. She turns to look at me, and I can't even pretend I wasn't staring. I don't want to. I want her, and I want her to know that I want her. She doesn't look away from me. Her lips part. They really are the nicest lips in the known universe. And she touches her tongue to her bottom one. I'm going to get up and I'm going to kiss her. No force on earth can stop me except that her song starts and crushes the moment with melancholy. I recognize the opening chords. It's "Fell on Black Days" by Soundgarden. The song starts with the band's lead singer, Chris Cornell, telling us that everything he's feared has come to life. It goes all the way downhill from there until we get to the chorus, where we learn 1 billion times, give or take, that he's fallen on black days. It is, objectively speaking, one of the most depressing songs ever written. Nevertheless, Natasha loves it. She strangles the mic with both hands and squeezes her eyes shut. Her singing is earnest and heartfelt and completely awful. It's not good. At all. I'm pretty sure she's tone deaf. Any note she does hit is purely coincidental. She sways awkwardly from side to side with her eyes closed. She doesn't need to read the lyrics because she knows this song by heart. By the time she gets to the final chorus, she's forgotten about me totally. Her awkwardness melts away. The singing is still not good, but she's got one hand over her heart, and she's belting a lyric about not knowing her fate with real emotion in her voice. Mercifully, it ends. It's a cure for happiness, that song. She peeks at me. I've never seen her look shy. She bites her bottom lip again and scrunches up her face. She's adorable. I love that song, she says. It's a little morose, isn't it? I tease. A little angst never hurt anyone. You're the least angst-ridden person I've ever met. Not true, she says. I'm just good at pretending. I don't think she meant to admit that to me. I don't think she likes to show her soft spots. She turns away and puts the mic down on the table. But I'm not letting her get away from this moment. I grab her hand and pull her toward me. She doesn't resist, and I don't stop pulling until the full lengths of our bodies are touching. I don't stop pulling until she's in my breathing space. That was the worst singing ever, I say. Her eyes are shining. I told you I was bad, she says. You didn't. In my head I did. Am I in your head? I ask her. She's so close that I can feel the slight heat from her blush. I put my hand on her waist and bury my fingers in her hair. Anything can happen in the breath of space between us. I wait for her eyes to say yes. And then I kiss her. Her lips are like soft pillows and I sink into them. We start out chaste, just lips touching, tasting, but soon we can't get enough. She parts her lips and our tongues tangle and retreat and tangle again. I'm hard everywhere, but it feels too good, too right to be embarrassed about. She's making little moaning sounds that make me want to kiss her even more. I don't care what she says about love and chemicals. This will not fade away. This is more than chemistry. She pulls away, and her eyes are shimmering black stars looking into mine. Come back, I say, and kiss her like there's no tomorrow.
I can't stop. I don't want to stop. My body absolutely does not care what my brain thinks. I feel his kiss everywhere. The tips of my hair, the center of my belly, the backs of my knees. I want to pull him into me and I want to melt into him. We move backward and the back of my legs bump into the couch. He guides me down until he's half on top of me, but with one leg still on the ground. I need to keep kissing. My body is hectic. I can't get enough. I can't get close enough. Something chaotic and insistent builds inside me. I'm arching off the couch to get closer to him than I already am. His hand squeezes my waist and travels up to my chest. He brushes lightly over my breast. I wrap my arms around his neck and then thread my fingers into his hair. Finally, I've wanted to do that all day. Observable fact. I don't believe in magic. Observable fact. We are magic.
Holy.
Shit.
We cannot have sex in the Norebang. We can not. But I'm going to go ahead and admit that I want to. If I don't stop kissing her, I'm going to ask her to, and I don't want her to think I'm the kind of guy who would ask a girl he's just met to have sex in the Norebang after their first quasi-date, even though I'm totally that kind of guy because, Jesus Christ, I really do want to have sex with her right now, right here, in the Norebang.
My hands cannot stop touching him. They slide themselves out of his hair and down to the hard, shifting muscles of his back. Of their own volition, they slide over his butt. As I suspected, it is spectacular. Firm and round and perfectly proportioned. It's the kind of butt that requires holding. He should never wear pants. I palm and squeeze it, and it feels even better than I'd expected. He pushes himself up, arms on either side of my head, and smiles at me. It's not a melon, you know. I like it, I say, and squeeze again. It's yours, he tells me. Have you ever considered wearing chaps? I ask. Absolutely not. He says, laughing and blushing. I really like making him blush. He lowers himself and kisses me again. It feels like there's no part of me that's not being kissed right now. I drag my hands away from his butt and up to his shoulders to slow us down. If I kiss him anymore, it's just going to make it harder on me later. So, no more kissing.
I feel the hesitation in her lips. And to be honest, I'm a little freaked out by how intense this is, too. I push myself up and pull her up to seated. I palm the back of her neck and rest my forehead against hers. We're both breathing too fast, too ragged. I knew we had chemistry, but I didn't expect this. We're kindling amid lightning strikes. A lit match in dry wood. Fire danger signs and a forest waiting to be burned. Of all the ways today could have gone, I couldn't have predicted this. But now I'm sure that everything that's happened today has been leading me to her and us to this moment and this moment to the rest of our lives. Even Charlie's academic probation from Harvard feels like it's part of the plan to get us to this point. If not for Charlie and his fuck-up, my mom wouldn't have said what she did this morning. If she hadn't, I wouldn't have left so early for the haircut that I have not gotten yet. I wouldn't have gotten on the 7 train with the theological conductor looking for God. If not for him, I wouldn't have left the subway to walk, and I wouldn't have seen Natasha having her religious musical experience. If not for the conductor's talk of God, I wouldn't have noticed her Deus Ex Machina jacket. If not for that jacket, I wouldn't have followed her into the record store. If not for her thieving ex-boyfriend, I wouldn't have spoken to her. Even the jerk in the BMW deserves some credit. If he hadn't run that red, I wouldn't have gotten a second chance with her. All of it, everything, was leading us back here. When we're both breathing normally again, I kiss the tip of her nose. "Told you," I say, and kiss it again. "Nose fetishist," she says, and then, "What did you tell me?" I punctuate my words with nose kisses. We kiss, are, kiss, meant, kiss, to, kiss, be, kiss. She pulls away. Her eyes have been replaced by storm clouds, and she untangles her limbs from mine. It's hard to let her go, like pulling magnets apart. Did I freak her out with my talk of fate? She scoots over on the couch and puts way too much space between us. I don't want to let the moment go. A few seconds ago, I thought it would last forever. "Want to sing another one?" I ask. My voice rattles and I clear my throat. I look over at the TV. We didn't get a chance to see her score before we started kissing. It's 89%, which is terrible. It's pretty hard to get less than 90% in Norebang. She glances over at the TV too, but doesn't say anything. I can't fathom what's happening in her head. Why is she resisting this thing between us? She touches her hair, pulls on a strand and lets it go. Pulls on another and lets it go. "I'm sorry," she says. I slide over and close the distance she put between us. Her hands are clasped in her lap. "What are you sorry for?" I ask. "For running hot and cold." "You weren't so cold just a minute ago," I say, making the absolute lamest joke, along with puns, innuendos are the lowest form of humor, I could possibly make in this moment. I even waggle my eyebrows and then wait for her reaction. This could go either way. A smile overtakes her face. Those storm clouds in her eyes don't stand a chance. "Wow," she says, her voice warm around her smile. "You sure have a way with words." "And the ladies," I say, hamming it up even more. I'll make a fool of myself just to make her laugh. She laughs some more and leans back on the couch. "You sure you're qualified to be a poet?" That was the worst line I've ever heard. "You were expecting something more poetic," she says. "Are you kidding?" Most poems are about sex. She's skeptical. Do you have actual data to back that up? I want to see some numbers. Scientist, I accuse. Poet, she retorts. We both smile, delighted and not trying to hide our delight from each other. Most poems I've seen are about love or sex or the stars. You poets are obsessed with stars. Falling stars, shooting stars, dying stars. Stars are important, I say, laughing. Sure, but why not more poems about the sun? The sun is also a star, and it's our most important one. That alone should be worth a poem or two. Done. I will only write poems about the sun from now on, I declare. Good, she says. Seriously, though, I think most poems are about sex. Robert Herrick wrote a poem called To the Virgins, To Make Much of Time. She pulls her legs up to lotus position on the couch and doubles over with laughter. He did not. He did, I say. He was basically telling virgins to lose their virginity as soon as possible, just in case they died. God forbid you should die a virgin. Her laughter fades. Maybe he was just saying that we should live in the moment. As if today is all we have. She's serious again. And sad. And I don't know why. She rests the back of her neck against the sofa and looks up at the disco ball. Tell me about your dad, I say. I don't really want to talk about him. I know, but tell me anyway. Why do you say he doesn't love you? She picks her head up to look at me. You're relentless, she says, and flops her head back again. Persistent, I say. I don't know how to say it. My dad's primary emotion is regret. It's like he made some giant mistake in his past. Like he took a wrong turn, and instead of ending up wherever he was supposed to be, he ended up in this life with me and my mom and my brother instead. Her voice wobbles while she's saying it, but she doesn't cry. I reach out and take her hand, and we both watch the TV screen. Her dancing score has been replaced by a soundless ad for Atlantic City casinos. My mom makes these beautiful paintings, I say to her. Really incredible. I can still picture the tears in her eyes when my dad gave her the present. She'd said, Yobo, you didn't have to do that. It's something only for you, he said. You used to paint all the time. I was so surprised by that. I thought I knew everything about my mom. About both of them, really. But here was this secret history I didn't know about. I asked her why she stopped, and she waved her hand in the air like she was wiping the years away. Long time ago, she said. I kiss Natasha's hand and then confess. Sometimes I think maybe she made a wrong turn having us. Yes, but does she think that? I don't know, I say. And then, but if I had to guess, I would say I think she's happy with the way her life turned out. That's good, she says. Can you imagine living your whole life thinking you made a mistake? She actually shudders as she's saying it. I raise her hand to my lips and kiss it. Her breathing changes. I tug her forward, wanting to kiss her, but she stops me. Tell me why you want to be a poet, she says. I lean back and rub my thumb over her knuckles. I don't know. I mean, I don't even know if it's what I want for a career or anything. I don't get how I'm supposed to know that already. All I know is I like to do it. I really like to do it. I have thoughts and I need to write them down, and when I write them down, they come out as poems. It's the best I ever feel about myself besides... I stop talking, not wanting to freak her out again. She raises her head from the sofa. Besides what? Her eyes are bright. She wants to know the answer. Besides you. You make me feel good about myself, too. She pulls her hand out of mine. I think she's going into retreat mode again, but no. She leans forward and kisses me instead.
I kiss him to get him to stop talking. If he keeps talking, I will love him. And I don't want to love him. I really don't. As strategies go, it's not my finest. Kissing is just another way of talking, except without the words.
One day I will write an ode about kissing. I will call it Ode to a Kiss. It will be epic.
We'd probably still be kissing if our cranky waitress hadn't returned to demand to know if we wanted anything else to eat. We didn't, and it was time to go anyway. I still want to take him to the Museum of Natural History, my favorite place in New York. I tell him that and we walk outside. After the dark of the Norebang, the sun seems too bright. And not just the sun, everything seems too much. The city is much too loud and much too crowded. For a few seconds, I'm disoriented by the businesses stacked high on top of each other with Korean signage, until I remember that we're in Koreatown. This section of the city is supposed to look like Seoul. I wonder if it does. I squint against the sun and contemplate going back inside. I'm not ready for the rowdy, bustling reality of New York to reassert itself yet. That's the thought that brings me to my senses. Reality. This is reality. The smell of rubber and exhaust. The sound of too many cars going nowhere. The taste of ozone in the air. This is reality. In the Norebang, we could pretend. But not out here. It's one of the things I like most about New York City. It deflects any attempts you make to lie to yourself. We turn to each other at the same time. We're holding hands, but even that feels like pretend now. I tug my hand from his to adjust my backpack. He waits for me to give it back, but I'm not quite ready yet.
Area boy incapable of leaving well enough alone. We're sitting side by side on the train, and even though it keeps jostling us together, I can feel her slipping away. No one is seated across from us. We watch each other in the window. My eyes slide to her face as she looks away. Her eyes slide to mine as I do the same. Her backpack's in her lap and she's hugging it to her chest like it might get up and walk away at any second. I could reach out and take her hand, force the issue, but I want her to be the one to do it this time. I want her to acknowledge this thing between us out loud. I can't leave well enough alone. I want her to say the words, "We're meant to be." Something, anything, I need to hear them. To know that I'm not alone in this. I should let it go. I am going to let it go. "What are you so afraid of?" I ask, not letting it go at all.
I hate pretense, but here I am pretending. "What are you talking about?" I say to his reflection in the subway window instead of to him.
I almost believe that she doesn't know what I'm talking about. Our eyes meet in the window like it's the only place we can look at each other. "We're meant to be," I insist. It comes out all wrong, bossy and scolding and pleading all at the same time. "I know you feel it too." She doesn't say a word, just gets up and goes to stand by the train doors. If anger were like heat, I'd be able to see the waves radiating from her body. Part of me wants to go to her and apologize. Part of me wants to demand to know just what her problem is anyway. I make myself remain seated for the 2 stops left until the train finally screeches into the 81st Street station. The doors open. She pushes her way through the crowd and runs up the stairs. As soon as we're at the top, she shunts us to the side and swings around to face me.
"Don't you tell me what to feel,"
she whisper shouts. She's going to say something else but decides against it. Instead, she walks away from me. She's frustrated, but now I am too. I catch up with her.
"What's your problem?"
I actually throw my hands up in the air as I say it. I don't want to be fighting with her. Central Park is just across the street. The trees are lush and beautiful in their fall colors. I want to wander through the park with her and write poems in my notebook. I want her to make fun of me for writing poems in my notebook. I want her to educate me on the how and why the leaves change color. I'm sure she knows the exact science of it. She swings her backpack onto both shoulders and crosses her arms in front of her body.
"Meant to be doesn't exist," she says.
I don't want to have a philosophical discussion, so I concede.
"Okay.
But if it did, then..." She cuts me off.
"No. Enough. It just doesn't. And even if it did, we are definitely not."
"How can you say that?" I know I'm being unreasonable and irrational and probably lots of other things I shouldn't be. This is not something you can fight with another person about. You can't persuade someone to love you. A small breeze rustles the leaves around us. It's colder now than it's been all day.
"Because it's true. We're not meant to be, Daniel. I'm an undocumented immigrant. I'm being deported. Today is my last day in America. Tomorrow, I'll be gone."
Maybe there's another way to interpret her words. My brain picks out the most important ones and rearranges them, hoping for a different meaning. I even try to compose a quick poem, but the words won't cooperate. They just sit there, too heavy for me to pick up. Last, undocumented. America. Gone.
Ordinarily, something like this, fighting in public, would embarrass me. But I barely even notice anyone except Daniel. If I'm honest with myself, it's been like this all day. He presses his forehead into his hands, and his hair forms a curtain around his face. I don't know what I'm supposed to say or do now. I want to take the words back. I want to keep pretending. It's my fault that things went so far. I should have told him from the beginning. But I didn't think we'd get to this point. I didn't think I would feel this much.
"I postponed my appointment because of you."
My voice is so quiet that I don't know if I mean for her to hear me, but she does. Her eyes widen. She starts to say 3 different things before settling on,
"Wait, this is my fault?"
I'm definitely accusing her of something. I'm not sure what. A bike courier hops onto the sidewalk a little too close to us. Someone yells at him to use the street. I want to yell at him too.
"Follow the rules," I want to say.
"You could have warned me," I say. "You could have told me you were leaving."
"I did warn you,"
she says, defensive now.
"Not enough. You didn't say you'd be living in another country in less than 24 hours. I didn't know that we'd..."
I interrupt her. "You knew when we met what was going on with you.
It wasn't your business then,
and it is now?" Even though the situation is hopeless, just hearing her say it's my business now gives me some hope.
"I tried to warn you," she insists again. "Not hard enough?"
"Here's how you do it. You open your mouth and you say the truth. None of this crap about not believing in love and poetry. 'Daniel, I'm leaving,' you say. 'Daniel, don't fall in love with me,' you say."
"I did say those things."
She's not yelling, but she's not being quiet either. A very fashionable toddler in a peacoat gives us wide eyes and tugs on her father's hand. A tyranny of tourists, complete with guidebooks, checks us out like we're on display. I lower my voice.
Yes, but I didn't think you meant them. Whose fault is that?
She demands. I don't have anything to say to that, and we just stare at each other.
You can't really be falling for me, she says, quieter now.
Her voice is somewhere between distress and disbelief. Again, I don't have anything to say. Even I'm surprised by how much I've been feeling for her all day. The thing about falling is you don't have any control on your way down. I try to calm the air between us.
Why can't I be falling for you? I ask.
She tugs hard on the straps of her backpack.
Because that's stupid. I told you not to.
And now I've had enough. My heart's been on my sleeve all day, and it's pretty bruised up now.
Just great. You don't feel anything? Was I kissing myself back there?
You think a few kisses mean forever?
I think those kisses did.
She closes her eyes. When she opens them again, I think I see pity there.
Daniel, she begins.
I cut her off. I don't want pity.
No. Whatever. I don't want to hear it. I get it.
You don't feel the same. You're leaving. Have a nice life. I take all of 2 steps before she says,
You're just like my father.
I don't even know your father, I say while putting my jacket on. It feels tighter somehow. She folds her arms across her chest.
Doesn't matter. You're just like him. Selfish.
I am not. Now I'm defensive.
Yes, you are. You think the entire world revolves around you. Your feelings, your dreams.
I throw my hands up. There is nothing wrong with having dreams.
I may be a stupid dreamer, but at least I have them.
Why is that a virtue? She demands.
All you dreamer types think the universe exists just for you and your passion. Better than not having any at all.
She narrows her eyes at me, ready to debate.
Really? Why?
I can't believe I have to explain this.
That's what we're put on Earth to do.
No, she says, shaking her head. We're put here to evolve and survive. That's it.
I knew she'd bring science into it. She can't really believe that.
You don't believe that, I say. You don't know me well enough to say that, she says. Besides, dreaming is a luxury and not everyone has it.
Yes, but you do.
You're afraid of becoming your dad. You don't want to choose the wrong thing, so you don't choose anything at all. I know there's a better way for me to tell her this, but I'm not feeling like my best self right now.
I already know what I want to be, she says.
I can't stop myself from scoffing.
A data scientist or whatever? That's not a passion. It's just a job. Having dreams never killed anybody.
Not true, she says.
How can you be this naive?
Well, I'd rather be naive than whatever it is you are. You only see things that are right in front of your face.
Better than seeing things that aren't there.
And now we're at an impasse. The sun hides behind a cloud, and a cool breeze blows over us from across Central Park. We watch each other for a little while. She looks different out of the sunlight. I imagine I do too. She thinks I'm naive. More than that, she thinks I'm ridiculous. Maybe it's better to end things this way. Better to have a tragic and sudden end than to have a long, drawn-out one where we realize that we're just too different and that love alone is not enough to bind us. I think all these things. I believe none of them. The wind picks up again. It stirs her hair a little. I can picture it with pink tips so clearly. I would have liked to see it.
You should go, I tell him. So that's it? He asks. I'm glad he's being a jerk. It makes things easier. Are you thinking at all about me? I wonder how Natasha's feeling. How did she get to be an undocumented immigrant? Does she want to go live in a country she doesn't know at all? Is she completely devastated by what's happening to her life? I read guilt on his face. He takes a step toward me, but I back up. He stops moving. You're just waiting for someone to save you. Don't want to be a doctor? Don't be a doctor then. It's not that simple, he says quietly. I narrow my eyes at him. To quote you from 5 minutes ago, here's how you do it. You open your mouth and say what's true. Mom and Dad, I don't want to be a doctor, you say. I want to be a poet because I am stupid and don't know better, you say. You know it's not that easy, he says, even quieter than before. I tug on the straps on my backpack. It's time to go. We're just delaying the inevitable. You know what I hate? I ask. I really hate poetry. Yeah, I know, he says. Shut up, I hate it. But I read something once by a poet named Warson Shire. It says that you can't make a home out of human beings, and that someone should have told you that. I expect him to tell me that the sentiment is not true. I even want him to, but he doesn't say anything. Your brother was right. There's no place for this to go. Besides, you don't love me, Daniel. You're just looking for someone to save you. Save yourself.
Ariatine convinced that his life is complete and utter shit. How I want her to be right. How I want not to be falling in love with her at all. I watch her walk away, and I don't stop her or follow her. What an absolute idiot I've been. I've been acting like some mystical, crystal-worshipping dummy. Of course this is what's happening now. All this nonsensical talk about fate and destiny and meant to be. Natasha's right. Life is just a series of dumb decisions and indecisions and coincidences that we choose to ascribe meaning to. School cafeteria out of your favorite pastry today? It must be because the universe is trying to keep you on your diet. Thanks, universe. You missed your train? Maybe the train's going to explode in the tunnel. Or patient zero for some horrible bird flu, waterfowl, goose, pterodactyl, is on that train, and thank goodness you weren't on it after all. Thanks, universe. No one bothers to follow up with destiny, though. The cafeteria just forgot there was another box in the back, and you got a slice of cake from your friend anyway. You fumed while waiting for another train, but one came along eventually. No one died on the train you missed. No one so much as sneezed. We tell ourselves there are reasons for the things that happen, but we're just telling ourselves stories. We make them up. They don't mean anything.
Fate, a history. Fate has always been the realm of the gods, though even the gods are subject to it. In ancient Greek mythology, the three sisters of fate spin out a person's destiny within 3 nights of their birth. Imagine your newborn child in his nursery. It's dark and soft and warm, somewhere between 2 and 4 a.m., one of those hours that belong exclusively to the newly born or the dying. The first sister, Clotho, appears next to you. She's a maiden, young and smooth. In her hand she holds a spindle, and on it she spins the threads of your child's life. Next to her is Lachesis, older and more matronly than her sister. In her hands, She holds the rod used to measure the thread of life. The length and destiny of your child's life is in her hands. Finally, we have Atropos. Old, haggardly, inevitable. In her hand she holds the terrible shears she'll use to cut the thread of your child's life. She determines the time and manner of his or her death. Imagine the awesome and awful sight of these three sisters pressed together, presiding over his crib, determining his future. In modern times, the sisters have largely disappeared from the collective consciousness, but the idea of fate hasn't. Why do we still believe? Does it make tragedy more bearable to believe that we ourselves had no hand in it? That we couldn't have prevented it? It was always ever thus. Things happen for a reason, says Natasha's mother. What she means is fate has a reason, and, though you may not know it, there's a certain comfort in knowing that there's a plan. Natasha is different. She believes in determinism, cause and effect. One action leads to another. Your actions determine your fate. In this way, she's not unlike Daniel's dad. Daniel lives in the nebulous space in between. Maybe he wasn't meant to meet Natasha today. Maybe it was random chance after all. But once they met, the rest of it, the love between them, was inevitable.
I'm not going to let this thing with Daniel stop me from going to the museum. This is one of my favorite areas of the city. The buildings here aren't quite as tall as those in Midtown. It's nice being able to see patches of uninterrupted sky. 10 minutes later, I'm in the museum in my favorite section, the Hall of Meteorites. Most people head right through this room to the gemstone one next door, with its flashy precious and semi-precious rocks. But I like this one. I like how dark and cool and spare it is. I like that there's hardly ever anyone here. All around the room, vertical cases with shining spotlights display small sections of meteorites. The cases have names like Jewels from Space, Building Planets, and Origins of the Solar System. I head right over to my favorite of all the meteorites, Aneguito. It's actually just a section of the much larger Cape New York meteor. Aneguito is 34 tons of iron and is the largest meteorite on display in any museum. I step up to the platform that it sits on and trail my hands across it. The surface is metal cold and pockmarked from thousands of tiny impacts. I close my eyes, let my fingers dip in and out of the divots. It's hard to believe that this hunk of iron is from outer space. Harder still to believe that it contains the origins of the solar system. This room is my church, and standing on this platform is my pillar. Touching this rock is the closest I ever come to believing in God. This is where I would have taken Daniel. I would have told him to write poetry about space rocks and impact craters. The sheer number of actions and reactions it's taken to form our solar system, our galaxy, our universe is astonishing. The number of things that had to go exactly right is overwhelming. Compared to that, what is falling in love? A series of small coincidences that we say means everything because we want to believe that our tiny lives matter on a galactic scale? But falling in love doesn't even begin to compare to the formation of the universe. It's not even close.
Symmetries, a poem by Daniel J. Ho Bay. I will stay on my side. And you will stay on an other.
My father and I were close once, in Jamaica, and even after we moved here, we were inseparable. Most times it felt like me and my dad, the dreamers, against my mom and my brother, the non-dreamers. He and I watched cricket together. I was his audience when he ran lines for auditions. When he was finally a famous Broadway actor, he would get me all the best parts for little girls, he'd say. I listened to his stories about how our life would be after he became famous. I listened long after my mom and brother had stopped listening. Things started to change about 4 years ago, when I was 13. My mom got sick of living in a one-bedroom apartment. All her friends in Jamaica lived in their own houses. She got sick of my dad working in the same job for basically the same pay. She got sick of hearing what would happen when his ship came in. She never said anything to him, though, only to me. You children too big to be sleeping in the living room, no. You need your privacy. I never going to have a real kitchen and a real fridge. It's time for him to give up that foolishness now. And then he lost his job. I don't know if he was fired or laid off. My mom said once that she thought he quit, but she couldn't prove it. On the day it happened, he said, maybe it's a blessing in disguise. Give him more time to pursue me acting. I don't know who he was talking to, but no one responded. Now that he wasn't working, he said he would audition for roles, but he hardly ever did. There was always an excuse. Me not right for that part. Them not going to like me accent, man. Me getting too old now. Acting is a young man game. When my mom got home from work in the evening, my father told her he was trying, but my brother and I knew better. I still remember the first time we saw him disappear into a play. Peter and I had walked home from school. We knew something strange was up because the front door was hanging open. Our father was in the living room, our bedroom. I don't know if he didn't hear us come in, but he didn't react. He was holding a book in his hand. Later I realized it was actually a play, A Raisin in the Sun. He was wearing a white button-up shirt and slacks and reciting the lines. I'm not sure why he was even holding the play because he already had it memorized. I still remember parts of the monologue. The character said something about seeing his future stretched out in front of him and how it, the future, was just a looming empty space. When my father finally noticed us watching, he scolded us for sneaking up on him. At first, I thought he was just embarrassed. No one likes being caught unawares. Later, though, I realized it was more than that. He was ashamed, as if we caught him cheating or stealing. After that, he and I didn't do much of anything together anymore. He stopped watching cricket. He turned down all my offers to help him memorize lines. His side of my parents' bedroom grew more cluttered with stacks of used and yellowed paperbacks of famous plays. He knew all the roles, not just the leads, but the bit parts as well. Eventually, he stopped with all pretense of auditioning or looking for a job. My mom gave up the pretense that we'd ever own a house or even find an apartment with more than one bedroom. She took extra shifts at work to make ends meet. Last summer, I got a job at McDonald's instead of volunteering at New York Methodist Hospital like I used to. It's been over 3 years of this. We come home from school to find him locked in his bedroom, running lines with no one. His favorite parts are the long, dramatic monologues. He is Macbeth and Walter Lee Younger. He complains bitterly about this or that actor and his lack of skill. He heaps praise on those he judges to be good. 2 months ago, through no fault of his own, he got a part. Someone he'd met years ago during one of his auditions was staging a production of A Raisin in the Sun. When he told my mom, the first thing she asked was, "How much you getting paid?" Not congratulations. Not I'm so proud of you. Not which part or when is it or are you so excited? Just how much you getting paid. She looked at him with flat eyes when she said it. Unimpressed eyes. Tired eyes that had just come off 2 shifts in a row. I think we were all a little shocked. She'd even shocked herself. Yes, she'd been frustrated with him for years, but that one moment showed us all how far apart they really were now. Even Peter, who sides with my mother in all things, flinched a little. Still, you couldn't fault her. Not really. My father had been dreaming his life away for years. He lived in those plays instead of the real world. He still does. My mother didn't have time for dreaming anymore. Neither do I.
Samuel Kingsley, A History of Regret, Part 3. He's a little afraid of Natasha, to be honest. The things she's interested in now? Chemistry and physics and math. Where did they come from? Sometimes when he looks at her doing her homework at the kitchen table, he thinks she belongs to someone else. Her world is bigger than him, and the things he taught her to be interested in. He doesn't know when she outgrew him. One night, after she and Peter had gone to bed, he went to the kitchen for water. She'd left her math book and homework on the table. Samuel doesn't know what overcame him, but he turned on the light, sat down, and flipped through the book. It looked like hieroglyphics, like some ancient language left by a time and a people he could never hope to understand. It filled him with a kind of dread. He sat there for a long time, running his fingers over the symbols, wishing his skin were porous enough to let all the knowledge and history of the world in. After that night, every time he looked at her, he had the vague sense that someone had come in when he wasn't looking and snatched his sweet little girl away. Sometimes, though, he still catches a glimpse of the old Natasha. She'll give him a look like she used to when she was younger. It's a look that wants something from him. A look that wants him to be more, do more, and love more. He resents it. Sometimes he resents her. Hasn't he done enough already? She's his first child. He's already given up all his dreams for her.
I don't know what to do with myself now. I'm supposed to be blowing with the wind, but there's no wind anymore. I want to get a hobo outfit and a sandwich board and scrawl, "What now, universe?" across it. Now might be a good time to admit that the universe is not paying attention, though. It's fair to say that I hate everything and everyone. The universe is an asshole, just like Charlie. Charlie, that sack of shit. Charlie, who told my would-be girlfriend that we didn't stand a chance. Charlie, who accused her of being a shoplifter. Charlie, who told her I had a small dick. Charlie, who I've wanted to punch in the face for 11 years now. Maybe this is the wind, my hate for Charlie. No time like the present. I've got nothing left to lose today.
The paralegal is a little more rumpled when I see her this time. A lock of her hair is out of place and falls into her eyes. Her eyes are glitter under the fluorescent lights, and her bright red lipstick is gone. She looks like she's been kissed. I check my phone to make sure I'm not too early or late, but I'm right on time. Welcome back, Miss Kingsley. Follow me, please. She stands and begins walking. Attorney Fitzgerald is just through here. She knocks quietly at the only door and waits, eyes even brighter than before. The door swings open. I might as well not be standing there, because Attorney Fitzgerald doesn't see me at all. He looks at his paralegal in a way that makes me want to apologize for intruding. She's looking at him in the same way. I clear my throat very loudly. Finally, he drags his eyes away from her.
"Thank you, Miss Winter," he says.
He might as well be declaring his love. I follow him. He sits down at his desk and presses his fingers against his temples. He's got a small bandage just above his eyebrow and another around his wrist. He looks like an older and more harried version of the picture on his website. The only things that are the same are that he's white and his eyes are bright green.
"Sit, sit, sit, sit,"
he says, all in one breath.
"Sorry for the delay. I had a little accident this morning, but now we don't have much time, so please, tell me how this all came to pass."
I'm not sure where to begin. Should I tell this lawyer the entire history? What should I include? I feel like I need to go back in time to explain it all. Should I tell him about my father's aborted dreams? Should I tell him that I think dreams never die, even when they're dead? Should I tell him that I suspect my father lives a better life in his head? In that life, he's renowned and respected. His kids look up to him. His wife wears diamonds and is the envy of men and women alike. I would like to live in that world, too. I don't know where to begin, so I start with the night he ruined our lives.
Natasha Kingsley, A Daughter's History.
The theater was even smaller than Peter and I expected. The sign said, "Maximum capacity, 40 people. Tickets were $15 each, with the proceeds going to cover the rental of the space for 2 hours on a Wednesday night. The actors weren't given complimentary tickets for friends and family, so he had to buy 3 for us. My father loves ritual and ceremony, but has very few things to be ritualistic or ceremonial about. Now he had this play and these tickets. He couldn't help himself. First he went out and picked up Chinese takeout, General Tso's chicken and shrimp fried rice for everyone. He sat us all down at the very small table in our kitchen. We never eat at the table because it's cramped with more than 2 people sitting at it. That night, though, he insisted we eat together as a family. He even served us himself, which is a thing that had never happened before. To my mom, he said, 'See, I got paper plates so you don't have a bunch of dishes to wash up later.' He said it with a perfect American accent. My mom didn't respond. We should have taken that as a sign. As soon as we were done eating, he stood and held a plain white envelope up in the air like it was a trophy.
'Let's see what we have for dessert,' he said.
He made and held eye contact with each of us in turn. I watched as my mom cut her eyes away from him before he moved on to Peter and then to me.
'My family, please do me the very great honor of coming to see me perform the role of Walter Lee Younger in the Village Troupe's production of A Raisin in the Sun.'
Then he opened the envelope slowly, like he was at the Academy Awards announcing the Best Actor category. He took out the tickets and handed one to each of us. He looked so proud. More than that, he looked so present. For a few minutes, he wasn't lost in his head or a play or some dream fantasy. He was right there with us, and he didn't want to be somewhere else. I'd forgotten what that was like. He has this gaze that can make you feel seen. There was a time when my father thought the world of me, and I really missed it right then. More than that, though, I missed the days when I thought the world of him and thought he could do no wrong. I used to believe that all it took to make him happy was us, his family. There are pictures of me from when I was 3 wearing a 'My Dad is the Coolest' t-shirt. On it there was a father penguin and a daughter penguin holding hands, surrounded by icy blue hearts. I wish I still felt that way.